Early October 1993, and as Americans went about their daily business, many were stunned to hear of the dramatic events that had taken place thousands of miles away, in the impoverished, war-torn country of Somalia, involving their own troops in a city few of them had ever heard of. Fought on the streets of the Somali capital, the Battle of Mogadishu, as American history books refer to it, took place on the afternoon of October 3, 1993, through the night and into the next morning. For American forces, it would prove one of the most intense urban battles since the Vietnam War, 2 decades earlier, and consequently they suffered more dead and wounded, in a matter of hours, than recent years of operations combined, culminating in the shootdown of 2 US Army UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters. Yet despite these factors, the battle itself is considered a tactical success for the US forces involved. For despite daunting odds, political restrictions in the planning stage and unforeseen mishaps, a force of less than 100 US troops held off more than 10 times their own number of heavily armed hostiles, who poured streams of bullets and rocket-propelled grenades at their position, in an intense, coordinated ambush. In today's episode, we're going to examine the events leading up to the battle itself, and the fallout from the whole affair, which is known around the world as the Black Hawk Down incident. Intervention. 1992, and the US military complex was riding high. Not only had it emerged victorious from the Cold War without having had to engage the Soviet Union in an armed nuclear conflict, but it had also led a multinational coalition of nations in a stunning defeat of Saddam Hussein's Iraq army, then the fifth largest in the world, following his unprovoked invasion of Kuwait. In 1991, war in the Gulf had a profound impact on not just the way wars would be fought thereafter, but also how they were perceived at home. The technological might demonstrated by the United States armed forces against the Iraqis not only helped wipe away the stain of defeat in Vietnam, but it also, rather deceivingly, made war appear like it could now be fought cleanly. Targeting pod footage of smart bombs being sent down ventilation shafts of buildings overshadowed the 3-day grisly ground battles that ended the conflict, leading to a belief such technology could render the notion of troops in close-quarter combat obsolete. Of course, many military leaders and analysts warned against this notion, declaring that the war would never be like a video game. But few outside of the military complex took heed of this warning, and it left US politicians feeling as though there was no military operation the US couldn't achieve cleanly and surgically. Few places around the world at that time demonstrated the brutal and bitter realities of warfare than the situation in Somalia. Already blighted by drought and famine, the country erupted into civil war in 1988. Factions rising up against the socialist government under President Major General Mohamed Siad Barre, overthrowing him in 1991. The rebel factions then began turning on one another, fighting over land and food supplies, only worsening the already dire humanitarian crisis. In some ways, food supplies became a weapon, as warlords such as General Mohamed Farah Aidid actively chose to starve opponents and their families to death. An estimated 300,000 people died of starvation in the first quarter of 1992, while 1.5 million were declared by the United Nations as on the verge of malnutrition. A further 3 million people had fled the country as refugees, looking to escape the violence. All this in a country whose population was only around 10 million, or nearly the equivalent of London in 2023. The world was appalled and looked to the UN for a solution. The UN Security Council helped broker a ceasefire between Aidid's forces and his biggest rival in the form of the faction led by Ali Mahidi Mohamed. While both men agreed to the ceasefire, they proved difficult to work with and repeatedly frustrated efforts to establish a lasting peace and to send aid to starving civilians. Additionally, the UN passed Resolution 751, which looked to establish a small peacekeeping force to monitor the ceasefire and help move aid through the country. Initially comprising of 50 peacekeepers, primarily from Africa or Muslim countries such as Egypt, when it became clear that the ceasefire existed, mostly on paper, the force was increased. However, through the summer of 1992, it was becoming increasingly clear that the situation was still deteriorating. And even Mohamed Farah Aidid and Ali Mahidi Mohamed were struggling to hold on to power, their own factions splintering into smaller ones. Many of these factions took to actively attacking the peacekeeper force, who were often ill-equipped for handling such intense combat. Sensing weakness, by November 1992, Mohamed Farah Aidid began to formally defy the Security Council and openly demanded the withdrawal of the peacekeeping force, as well as declaring hostile intent against any further UN deployments. Pressure was now mounting on the United States government to intervene, but the government of George Bush was already becoming embroiled in the deteriorating situation in the Balkans, and in particular in Bosnia. Both situations had shades of the story of the Vietnam War to them, so there was little appetite for a full-scale intervention in either. However, on the flip side, the US couldn't sit back and simply do nothing, as the UN Security Council was being actively defied, and peacekeepers were under attack. Operation Restore Hope. Chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staffs, General Colin Powell, one of the stars of the campaign to oust Saddam Hussein, recommended a massive but short US intervention under US rather than UN command to facilitate the delivery of relief supplies and prevent a total collapse of the UN mission in Somalia, which by then was effectively under siege. Powell believed that this would allow the United States to retain the initiative, minimizing the risk to American forces, and offer the UN the necessary breathing space to assemble a larger and more capable peacekeeping force that would take over as soon as possible, thus preventing the US from being dragged into a long campaign. For President Bush, this appeared to be the low-risk option, while at the same time helping to maintain the power and influence of the UN Security Council, as well as building on US military prestige. It would also answer his critics over the handling of the headline-grabbing Somali situation, just as an election year was about to kick off in the US. Preparations got underway in early December 1992, as the UN drafted another Security Council, Resolution 794, legitimizing the mission on December 3rd. Dubbed Operation Restore Hope, the intervention began on December 8th and was headed up by the US Marine Corps 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, although it was a multi-service campaign operating under the direction of a Unified Task Force, or UNITAF, with overall command given to the Marine Lieutenant General Robert B. Johnson. In the early hours of December 9th, Special Forces teams landed in Somalia ahead of the main force of 1,300 Marines who were flown over the beach and into Mogadishu Airport. Rather than bursts of gunfire from hostile warlords, they were instead greeted by the flashes of the world's media, which had descended on the airport to report on the event. In general, the US forces were met with cries of jubilation from the local population. Many of the warlords knew they couldn't hope to face off against the awesome firepower of a United States military expedition force, and so either drifted away into the countryside or agreed to cooperate, some going as far as to surrender their heavy weapons. UNITAF thus succeeded in its objective of quickly achieving some degree of stability to save the UN mission there from collapse and secure aid convoys to the starving population. While a US mission, US forces were also aided by troops from 23 allied countries such as Australia, Canada, France, Morocco, and Pakistan. And at its height, Restore Hope involved 38,000 troops, and they worked to support personnel from some 49 international relief agencies. Back in the United States, there was a feeling of mission accomplished, and now the race was on to transfer the ongoing mission back to the UN and withdraw UNITAF. The fear was always that in such a complex environment that an incident would occur by accident, that would in some way force the United States to expand its mission and draw them into possibly years of bloody warfare. The Gulf War may have helped erase the stain of Vietnam, but its legacy was still firmly embedded in the minds of everyone back home. There were several small-scale skirmishes with bandits or uncooperative factions, as well as a few tragic mistakes. A US soldier shot a small boy seemingly running towards him with what he assumed was a bomb, but which proved to be a harmless box. The soldier was deemed to have acted accordingly, given the rules of engagement. However, the same could not be said for a US soldier who shot a man who had stolen his sunglasses. Nevertheless, the overall situation was managed carefully through a combination of military and diplomatic means. And so, starting in late April, Restore Hope began to wind down as the new, more robust UN force was assembled. On May 4th, Restore Hope was formally suspended, while the UN force was under the overall command of Turkish Army Lieutenant General Servak Bur. His deputy was US Army Major General Thomas M. Montgomery, thus allowing the US to maintain influence in the ongoing mission. The most wanted man in Somalia. The transition was anything but orderly, and the new UN force was still arriving in the days after Restore Hope had ended. Furthermore, while the US troops and their allies had the begrudging respect of the warlords, the UN troops were viewed as weaker, or not as committed to their mission. Thus, hostility directed towards the new wave of foreign troops grew exponentially in the weeks and months after. This despite the US leaving behind a 1,100-man ground-based, quick reaction force detached from the 10th Mountain Division and a substantial logistics support chain. The violence towards the peacekeepers would climax on June 5, 1993, when members of the Somali National Alliance, under the chairmanship of Mohammed Farah Aidid, ambushed a Pakistani peacekeeping force. 24 UN Pakistani troops were killed, and 44 more were injured. The next day, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 837, authorizing a more aggressive stance against Aidid and his followers. UN troops began conducting patrols in armored vehicles throughout Mogadishu in a show of defiance, while the United States dispatched Lockheed AC-130 gunships for heavy fire support should Aidid attempt another such ambush. As well as their direct fire role, the AC-130s also flew numerous psychological warfare missions and carried out their own raids against Aidid's network, targeting his weapon storage facilities and his own propaganda radio station. Aidid himself soon became the most wanted man in Somalia, and a reward was posted of $25,000, a substantial sum for the ordinary Somali. US Task Force 325 Aviation was given the job of apprehending Aidid, but despite several promising leads, Aidid was always able to give them the slip. Aidid didn't take the attention he was receiving lightly and retaliated by detonating a bomb under a US Army military police vehicle in Mogadishu on August 8, 1993, killing 4 MPs. In response, the Secretary of Defense, now Les Aspin of the Clinton administration, directed the deployment of a Joint Special Operations Task Force to directly deal with Aidid and his supporters. Dubbed Task Force Ranger, the combined unit featured elements from a variety of specialist US teams, including Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, and Delta, and were supported by a number of Special Forces helicopters, optimized for all-weather / day-night operations. Under the overall command of General Joseph P. Hoare, despite the unit's goal of arresting Aidid and handing him to the UN, the force operated outside of the UN command structure. Task Force Ranger began conducting raids on known safe houses of Aidid and his supporters, 6 in total between August and September 1993. All were successful bar one, the exception being the mistaken raiding of an unregistered UN building, and the UN workers finding themselves being temporarily detained. However, while Aidid himself remained an elusive foe, Task Force Ranger scored a major coup when on September 21st, they conducted an operation to snatch one of his top lieutenants in the form of Osman Atto. The snatch and grab operation took place near Mogadishu's dig for hospital and went fairly smoothly. However, as an omen of what was to come, the helicopters involved took heavy fire from rocket-propelled grenades or RPGs, weapons more traditionally used against armor and protected positions, and so would be devastating to the thinly skinned aircraft. While he remained free, Task Force Ranger had seriously hampered Ida's ability to function, and so like a trapped animal, he lashed out against the US and UN troops. His men continued to mount ambushes and plant bombs. Then in the early hours of September 25th, 4 days after Atto's capture, a US Black Hawk callsign, Courage 5-3, was conducting a reconnaissance flight over the city when it was fired upon by militants armed with RPGs. One grenade struck the aircraft, igniting the onboard fuel and killing 3 soldiers on board. Pilot Chief Warrant Officer Dale Schrader and co-pilot Perry Alleman fought to keep the damaged helicopter in the air long enough to reach friendly lines, but it was to no avail, and the aircraft went careering into a nearby building before slamming into the street. The 2 pilots were alive but in serious trouble as hostile forces moved in on them, looking to take valuable hostages. The race was now on to recover them. A US quick reaction force from the 10th Mountain Division raced to the scene in a 5-ton truck loaded with sandbags for protection. Upon arriving on the scene, they quickly found themselves being surrounded by armed Somalis. A fierce gunfight followed, and the US troops called in air support in the form of armed helicopters. In several instances, these aircraft were operating so close to the men from the 10th Mountain that expended shell cases rained down on them. Having recovered the pilots, the bodies of the dead troops and rigging the downed aircraft to explode, they began to pull out, but not before one sergeant lost his leg to an RPG detonation. The 3 who died were Private First Class Matthew K. Anderson, 21 of Lucas, Iowa, Sergeant Eugene Williams, 26 of Chicago, and Sergeant Ferdinand C. Richardson, 27 of Summerhead, California. Black Hawk Down. The arrival of October brought with it intelligence regarding the whereabouts of 2 more of IDID's senior commanders, located in a stronghold in the so-called Black Sea Slum district of Bakara Market, near the Olympic Hotel. Everyone involved in the planning of the snatch operation knew it was probably going to be the toughest raid yet. To that end, 160 troops were allocated to the operation, and they would ride in Mogadishu in a fleet of 19 helicopters and 12 ground vehicles, although a request for armored vehicles was denied. The aircraft were to transport the main assault force to storm the compound, as well as a blocking force who would secure the perimeter to prevent hostile units from converging on the scene. The ground unit would then race in, load the prisoners onto their trucks, and speed out before the assault and blocking teams withdrew back to their aircraft. At 15:30 hours on October 3rd, the operation began, and the fleet of Sikorsky MH-60 Black Hawks, supported by the smaller egg-shaped MH-6 Little Birds, were soon lifted off from their base at the airport with the assault and blocking teams. Within minutes, the aircraft arrived on the scene, and the blocking force quickly established their perimeter, while the assault team stormed the stronghold. During the insertion, Ranger Private First Class Todd Blackburn missed the rope that he was descending down from his hovering Black Hawk and fell 70 feet to the street below, becoming the first US casualty of the day. Almost immediately, both teams came under sustained heavy fire, as did their support aircraft, orbiting overhead. But it was not long before they managed to secure 24 detainees. The trucks were now battling their way to the scene, which was increasingly becoming swamped with armed hostiles, including women and children, all firing on the US force. One truck was disabled by an RPG and had to be abandoned en route. But by 1600 hours they were on the scene and the detainees were being loaded, while 3 other vehicles were ordered to transport the injured Private Blackburn to safety. During his evacuation, Sergeant Dominic Piller was shot and killed, becoming the first US fatality of the day. Meanwhile, confusion reigned as it was unclear who was to signal the start of the withdrawal, costing the US troops precious minutes. Then, disaster struck. Orbiting overhead, providing support was MH-60 Black Hawk callsign Super 61, which began taking fire. At the controls was CW-3 Cliff Walcott, known to everyone as Elvis. Suddenly the aircraft was rocked by an impact from an RPG, and it went into an uncontrollable spin before crashing down against the side of a nearby building. Both Walcott and his co-pilot, CW-3 Donovan Lee Briley, were killed in the crash, and two crew members were seriously injured. Two snipers on board, Staff Sergeant Daniel Bush and Sergeant Jim Smith, survived intact enough to begin laying down fire against the groups that were converging on their position. After the shootdown, ground forces converged on its position, and an MH-6 Little Bird, callsign Star 41, landed in the adjacent street to attempt to evacuate the casualties. The pilot went to assist the survivors, successfully pulling two of the wounded soldiers into the Little Bird, while the co-pilot laid down suppressive fire from the cockpit with his personal weapon. Under intense ground fire, the MH-6 was then forced to depart with its crew and survivors. Elements of the blocking force soon reached the scene, followed by a dedicated combat search and rescue Black Hawk. As the Black Hawk roped in the rescue team, it too was hit, but its pilot managed to keep control of it long enough for the team to be safely inserted, and then nursed his aircraft to safety, making an emergency landing at the airport. In the brutal fighting that followed, the US took several more casualties, including Ranger Corporal Jamie Smith, who was left in a critical condition. In the air, Super 61's place was taken by another Black Hawk callsign, Super 64, flown by Chief Warrant Officer Michael Durant. While flying over the crash site, an RPG was fired up at the aircraft, which was subsequently hit in the tail rotor. Durant was initially able to keep control of the aircraft and began to withdraw back to base, but then the entire rotor assembly disintegrated and the aircraft entered an uncontrollable spin. The aircraft crashed into a group of tin shacks and killed several civilians on the ground, which only enraged more of the population into action against the American troops. They were spurred on by IDA's men, taking to loudspeakers, demanding every Somali defend their home and their faith from the Americans. Durant was seriously injured in the crash, but was alive. Orbiting near the second crash site was Black Hawk Super 62, on board of which were two US Army Delta snipers. Sergeant First Class Randy Shughart and Master Sergeant Gary Gordon. Observing the groups of hostiles approaching the scene, they made a request to be inserted onto the scene to provide assistance to any survivors. That request was denied. It being felt, they could do more from the chopper, but Gordon repeated the request, and after being advised that they could not guarantee their safety, which did little to dissuade the two men, they were inserted by Super 62 at 16:42 hours. Super 62 remained on station overhead, providing fire support, but then just 10 minutes later, the Somalis fired yet more RPGs, and one scored a direct hit on the Black Hawk, hitting the cockpit and damaging the engine. It left the co-pilot unconscious, but despite the damage, it was able to limp away to safety. But leaving the snipers and the survivors of Super 64 to fend largely for themselves against hundreds of angry Somalis. Rescue effort. Meanwhile, the effort was still underway by the convoy to reach the first crash site. Travelling down narrow streets, they were caught in a near-continuous ambush of machine gun fire, RPGs and explosives. It didn't help that navigating the streets proved a unique challenge, as with so much fighting, the streets often barely resembled any maps the Americans had. As such, the convoy became lost, only adding to the time they were caught up in the hellscape of war-torn Mogadishu. Then, just over half an hour since Super 61 had gone down, the convoy could do no more. It had sustained numerous casualties and damage to its vehicles, and it was felt that even if they could find the crash site, they would only be adding to the growing problem of evacuating the site rather than helping. The convoy was therefore directed to begin fighting its way out of the city back to the airport. At the airport, a quick reaction force was hastily assembled, ready to charge out and provide assistance, just like it had done when Courage 5-4 was lost. However, IDID had also learned from the earlier incident and had his own contingency plans put in place for them. The QRF convoy thus encountered resistance almost immediately after leaving the airport. In the end, the hostile fire was so severe that even the QRF convoy was forced to abandon its charge towards the crash site, and instead fought its way to link up with a convoy coming out of the city so they could provide support to one another in the running battle back to the airport. With the two convoys returning to the airport, there were 99 known US troops left fighting for their lives in the city around the first crash site. For the Delta snipers at the second crash site, this spelled disaster. Just who was killed first is disputed, although the official version of events has it that Shughart was the first to die, after which Gordon picked up his weapon and handed it to the injured Durant so he could help continue the fight. Some sources differ, however, as it's believed that Durant misidentified who handed him the weapon after the first was killed. Shortly afterwards, Gordon was killed and the crash site was overrun. Except for Durant, all the survivors were beaten to death in a vicious frenzy at the hands of the crowd, and their bodies stripped, mutilated, and carried away like trophies for display. Before he could suffer the same fate, Durant's life was spared by the intervention of Yusuf Dahir Mulawim, who wished to take him as a hostage for Idid. The Rangers and Delta troops at the first crash site soon began to realize they were now faced with the daunting prospect of hunkering down for the night in the middle of what seemed like an entire city determined to kill them. Not expecting an operation of this magnitude, they lacked many of the essential equipment for effective night fighting, as night vision goggles and supplies in general were running desperately low. At 1908 hours, the air roared with the sound of an incoming Black Hawk call sign, Super 66, as its crew made a daring effort to drop in fresh water and ammunition, and to evacuate Corporal Smith. But the aircraft sustained such heavy fire that it too was almost lost. Unfortunately, this meant they were unable to evacuate the wounded corporal, and he died from his wounds at 20:27 hours. Back at the airport, an effort got underway to form up another convoy to attempt to reach the first crash site. The remainder of Task Force Ranger was organized at the city's new port, along with tanks and armored vehicles from the Malaysian and Pakistani UN contingents. Given the city was alive with activity, this formation did not go unnoticed by Idid's men. At 23:23 hours, the new convoy moved out into the city, coming under very heavy fire. Providing support were a number of AH-6 helicopters, gunship versions of the Little Bird, which strafed Somali positions, along with the harder-hitting BAL AH-1 Huey Cobras. The new rescue convoy stretched almost 2 miles long as it snaked through the city. One advantage they faced was that the fall of night, many of those in the city who answered Idid's call to arms had disengaged and gone home. However, that still left behind his hardcore militiamen. Many of these militiamen had a wealth of combat experience, as both American and UN troops learned to respect them. As well as the armed US helicopters overhead, Pakistani Army M48 tanks were also used to great effect, with their main guns clearing away roadblocks and firing into windows, from where concealed militiamen were firing their weapons. By the time the convoy started to reach the crash site at around 0200 hours on October 4th, several of their number had been killed and wounded, and a number of vehicles damaged or destroyed, but relief had come to the besieged US troops. As part of the evacuation effort, all of the bodies of the troops killed were to be recovered. But this presented a problem when it came to Wolcott's body, the pilot of Super 61. It would not be until 0530 hours that the convoy was ready to begin moving out again. However, once again there was a problem. The rescue effort had been hastily put together, as UN commanders were not informed of the raid beforehand, the fear being that this knowledge would filter down to Idid's informants. Therefore, the convoy, despite its size, didn't have room for everyone. And so, as the crash site was finally abandoned, several troops had to retreat on foot, using the vehicles for cover. However, in the chaos of events, they soon found themselves being left behind, forcing them to dash to a rendezvous point at the intersection of Hawlawadig Road and National Street. This has since gone down in US military law as the Mogadishu Mile. By 0630 hours, the battle was over, with the US troops being evacuated to the nearby stadium held by the Pakistani contingent of the UN forces. Fallout. The fallout from the battle was both dramatic and immediate. Americans awoke to the shocking news that 18 of their sons had died during the night, fighting in Mogadishu, with a 19th dying from his wounds 2 days later. Another 73 received various wounds from light to life-changing. It was the deadliest firefight involving US troops since the Vietnam War, and it helped dissolve the growing belief that future conflicts could be fought like a clean video game. Adding to this was the news that Durant was still being held hostage somewhere in Mogadishu. US helicopters overflew the city, with loudspeakers proclaiming that they would not leave him behind, to give him hope, and played music from AC/DC, his favorite band. Idid held Durant for 11 days before he and a Nigerian soldier, also taken by Idid's men, were released via the Red Cross. He returned to service and continued flying until 2001, when he retired and entered US politics. Following the battle, President Bill Clinton ordered all operations to capture Idid to cease, and shortly after, it was announced US forces would evacuate Somalia by March 1994. On December 15, 1993, US Secretary of Defense Les Aspin stood down and took much of the blame for the refusal to deploy armored fighting vehicles to support the operation. On February 4, 1994, the UN Security Council passed yet another resolution concerning Somalia. Resolution 897 set out the process for completing the UN mission in Somalia by March 1995, culminating with the withdrawal of all UN troops. Following a request from the UN on December 16, 1994, the US undertook Operation United Shield, and on February 7, 1995, a US-led multinational fleet arrived to facilitate the withdrawal of UN forces, this being completed on March 6th. After their withdrawal, Mohamed Farah Idid declared himself president of Somalia on June 15th, 1995. He was assassinated nearly 14 months later, leaving behind a nation still blighted by war and poverty. While many of those US troops involved were honored, the highest awards went to Gary Gordon and Randall Shugart, the two Delta snipers who insisted on being deployed to the crash site of Super 64. Both men received a posthumous Medal of Honor from President Bill Clinton. Additionally, they are now remembered by their names adorning two US Navy ships, the USNS Gordon and the USNS Shugart. The battle was an important lesson for the US military in the dangers posed by comparatively lighter armed, but tenacious and creative insurgents, as well as the challenges of urban combat. Many of their lessons would be applied nearly 10 years later during the War on Terror, by which time many of the younger troops involved in the battle had advanced to more senior positions, where they could impress this hard-earned experience on the new recruits under them to better prepare them for what lay ahead. Thank you for watching. Be sure to check out the sponsor of this documentary, Call of War, by clicking on the link in the description or comment section. Thank you. And we'll see you in the next video.